This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Last year, a mother in Durham decided to see for herself what in-school suspension looked like at her son's high school. Spent the day with him in an isolated high school room. Isolated room in the basement, she said she spotted bored kids without enough work to get them through the day. And she was most struck by something else. Nearly all the students in the room were boys of color, just like her son. She documented what she witnessed in a Facebook post that has since gone viral. That mother is our guest today. Reverend Fatima Saleh is a pastoral consultant in the Triangle area, the mother of four kids. Fatima, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Tell us how this whole thing got started. Your son got sent to ISS, right?
Sure. He got sent to ISS for horse playing, the words of the administrator who sent him. She said there was no one hurt. They were laughing, but they were horse playing in the cafeteria. And he got a day of ISS. From then on, he started laughing in ISS, and so then they gave him two more days of ISS for that. When he came home, he complained about ISS. He just said, all we do is face a wall. There's nothing to do. We can't. There's just nothing. We just face a wall. So I said, I doubt that that's what's happening. You need to pay for what you've done. This is accountability. And so I said, as much to prove him wrong, I said, I will sit with you in ISS, and one, to make sure you don't get more ISS, and two, to sort of dispel the idea that it couldn't possibly be like this.
Durham School of the Arts we're talking about.
Correct.
That was the school, and of course, having your mother there with you, that'll keep you from laughing.
Yes, it did.
School,
it
right?
did.
So you go there, and you're telling him, look, it can't be that bad. What did you find?
I found it was worse than he described. I walked into the classroom with the other students. He had picked his desk facing the wall, an electrical socket. His desk was butted up to the wall, and I was right behind him. I then noticed that throughout the day, some students were not giving any classwork at all, and the others ranged between having two to four of their courses, and their teachers responding with material. And DSA, Durham School of the Arts, is particular in that it has seven courses throughout the day. And four to five of them may be your major courses. So I was deeply struck by the fact that there was a number of students who just didn't have any work at all, and the rest were maybe operating out of maybe 40% of their classwork,
What do you do in ISS?
That's a good question. When you have no work, what you did is you tried not to fall asleep. Because if you fell asleep and your head hit the desk or you put your head on the desk, you got another day of ISS. You had to be completely still and quiet. If you made any sounds and noises, then it would be punishable by another day of ISS.
So you talked about this in the Facebook post. You brought stuff to do. You brought stuff to do with you. And you by about 11 o'clock, you'd about run out. Huh?
I brought my Kindle and I started reading because I'm like, certainly I love to read it. I'm a voracious reader. So I sat there and about 10:58 is when I recorded on the first day. I just also want to clarify that I spent two full days in ISS. So it was 14 hours together. Both days running almost alike. But that around 10:58, I kind of broke. I was like, this is ridiculous. I cannot even sit here. The environment and feeling, the energy of the room was just deeply harrowing. And the fact that I was looking at, out of the 13 students in there, 11 of them were brown, black boys like my son. So it was so disproportionate in who was getting punished. And then I started to hear some of their stories of why they were there. And that was also deeply troubling.
And we should note that the Durham School of the Arts is, in fact, a diverse school, but only 35% of the population is white. But you saw a different ratio in terms of what you saw in ISS.
Correct. It was anywhere between 80 to 90%. The first day was 11 out of 13, and the second day that I was there was 11 students, and nine of them were black boys.
Now, you didn't write this Facebook post right away. You talked to people at the school first, right?
Well, I talked to a teacher, and I had talked to other parents and other students, but I did not bring it up with the administrator. I just sat there, and I think I sat on it for a long time until my second son got ISS at DSA, and I said, well, it's now the Restorative Practice Center. He's like, all they changed was the paint. It's exactly the same.
We're talking about this change from it's now the Restorative Practice Center. It's something changed?
Yes.
They decided to revamp the way they were doing it?
Yes, sir.
Oh, so what did they tell you? So you did you think there was change in the works? Is that
correct? And that's why I never wrote the piece. It was at the end of last school year, and I heard that there were initiatives on board to change it from ISS to Restorative Practice Center. And then when my second son got ISS and said it was exactly the same.
And that's when you made the post.
Correct.
Well, I'm talking now to Reverend Fatima Saleh, who is a pastoral consultant in the Triangle and wrote that post on Facebook about her experience shadowing her son and in-school suspension. Last July, Durham Public School System announced a five-year, $5.5 million plan to improve safety in academics, and part of that plan was to replace in-school suspension with a restorative practice. They were going to be called restorative practice centers. Laverne Maddox-Perry is the Senior Executive Director of Student Support Services at Durham Public Schools, and she's the lead administrator heading up the project to get rid of in-school suspension. Welcome to the program, Laverne.
Thank you so much.
Talk to us more about this changeover and what's happening in Durham Public Schools.
Well, sure. So we have, as educators and as schools, been operating with ISS for a long time. Mm. Last spring and into the summer, Durham Public Schools made a decision with the support of the new superintendent and the school board that we no longer were going to engage in school suspension. We were going to invest our time in restorative practice centers with coordinators that were a part of a years-long tiered implementation plan for restorative practices across our schools. And so we began training in August 2018. And we started with restorative practice coordinators to really get moving in the direction away from punitive measures, such as mm-hmm. the ones mm-hmm. that the good pastor describes, into more restorative measures.
And what does that mean? What does that look like, restorative practices?
So restorative practices are basically those practices that are grounded in restorative justices. Restorative justice and that approach to moving from punitive mm-hmm. and doing things to students and to moving to a with and restorative perspective where you hope you get to a point where students are able to continue their learning, feel respected, have mutual accountability for getting work completed in those restorative practice centers, and largely focus on the reflection piece of accountability for one's actions. Should there have been some violation of the student code of conduct? How do you work with students to make sure they're accountable and receive a consequence? However, it's done in the most respectful and restorative manner, because what we know is that that's how behaviors
right.
change.
Well, it sounds like that even after this got underway, Durham School of the Arts is still sending kids to the basement, looking at a wall and not engaged in this kind of restorative practice that brings all the parties together to work through what it was that happened. So why is that?
The transition is in progress, mm-hmm. and I can tell you the account that the good pastor shared and that her son shared with her is no longer what Durham School of the Arts or any of our restorative practice centers look like. What her sharing her experience with us has done has really helped us to focus in on what things can we do immediately to show that not just the name change is occurring as we're getting the training, and it is a huge systemic shift, and it's going to cause a mindset shift. So it won't be done overnight. It is going to take us a long time. But what things can we put into action that demonstrate what is in our heart and our commitment to do? What can parents and students trust we're going to do differently? So we've started some of that stuff at Durham School of the Arts and other schools.
Fatima, it does sound like you're talking about a huge cultural shift here. Would you acknowledge it? I mean, it's going to take some time to do that. Are you satisfied that this is a process that's underway and may take some time to see the full fruit?
I'm weary of time. Time is what you do with it, according to Martin Luther King. And wait and is not a word that I'm comfortable with, especially when there are casualties happening right now. While the Restorative Practice Center still does not seem to address the disproportionate nature of Black, brown boys. So even if it's a Restorative Practice Center, if it's still housed and populated by this same disproportionate number of Black, brown boys leading us to a school-to-prison pipeline, I am deeply concerned that even if you change the makeup, that are we addressing that? And also, can students depend to get their classwork to them in the Restorative Practice Center? And what accountability is happening so that they're not in school and not being schooled?
What about that? Let's talk about this disproportion and disparity.
Absolutely.
in the kind of students that we see sent to disciplinary pursuit, whatever you're going to call them.
Right. So we acknowledge, that is an issue we've been working on for quite a few years, and with a new learning and new ideas about ways to address that, it continues to be in our focus, and we recognize that we have to address the disproportionality as much as we address. What we're finding is that we're trending down in terms of all discipline, including those exclusions from school and those exclusions just from class for a portion of the day, which is good news. However, we do know that we are working on the disproportionality, and we hope our restorative, and that's why we're investing so heavily in restorative practices and that restorative justice. And I was having a conversation with someone today, and it just occurred to me that the reason this is going to be powerful work to help us address exactly what the pastor is talking about is that it gives us an opportunity to give all students a chance to stop. It gives the adults a chance to stop and really try to restore relationship and to use reflection, questioning, and listening to one another to get to the point where you no longer have to be removed from your classroom. And it allows for eliminating some of the I'll just have to say it, implicit bias that may or may not exist in a particular school. It causes us all to pause and listen to one another and treat each student and each situation as an individual.
You talked about implicit bias. There are schools that have actually addressed that directly and found that where they had never believed and were shocked to find that implicit bias was there, things changed. And there's a way in which perhaps restorative practice, because of the reflection you talked about, may lead one to discover the implicit bias that's inherent in some of these disparities. So perhaps restorative practices could lead to some of the remedy. But what else are you doing to address directly? You said you've been thinking about it.
Oh, absolutely.
How do you address those?
So we see it as kind of like a three-pronged approach that we have to take as a district. Restorative practices and restorative justice, of course, is a part of it. But we also have to look at equity leadership and racial equity and addressing implicit bias. We've already started some of that training. We've started with leadership and with schools. And that's a tough conversation to have, but it's a conversation we have to have for it to be impactful. So in addition to that, we also are talking about culturally responsive pedagogy and what happens in the classroom. Students get put into an RPC because they're more than likely has been some interaction with another adult that draws attention. And so how do you utilize really culturally responsive pedagogy and tools so that the student doesn't have to leave the class at all? So all these, the three of them are the things that we're going to use to address some of this disproportionality.
We talked about a $5.5 million plan. What's the top priority in that plan overall? The whole plan is not about in-school suspension, right? I mean,
right.
It's a much larger plan than that. Sounds like it's a big plan, a strategic plan.
Right.
What are the goals? What are the primary goals in that
plan? For the strategic plan,
yes,
there are
five
of them. There are five goals for our strategic plan, and they range. We, as a district, have pretty much laid out what we're going to be working on for the next 5 years. And those include, of course, increasing academic achievement. That's a part of why what we do is probably the main thing that people go to school for. But also there's another priority, which is around the whole child. And that is a lot of my work, creating an environment where students feel supported, that is still safe, that there is a feeling of accountability, but we have supports in place for all members of our community. There's also an emphasis on diversifying so that we can have those conversations and have representatives from all walks of our community in our schools as teachers. So a priority for us is also diversifying our teaching and leadership populations to be more reflective of our student populations. We're also increasing parent and community engagement. That's one of our priorities, is how are we engaging with parents so that we can have those conversations that are sometimes difficult to have in a manner that builds trust and doesn't degrade that. So that's a huge right. priority. And then, of course, as a public school, we have to be fiscally responsible. We want to make sure that our operating costs and that the taxpayers' investment in our schools are rendering the types of results that they can be proud of in Durham Public Schools.
Fatima, you have had conversations with, you've spoken before the school board, you talked to the administrators at the Durham School of the Arts. What were those conversations like, and are you satisfied with those conversations? What were they telling you about the situation?
That's a hard question. I wasn't as hopeful when I finished with some conversations with leaders, some of them actually not wanting to admit that this could be a racial problem. And so when that is said, and not so many words, that this is not a race problem, then I begin to be very weary that we can do the work to dismantle racism and our part in the school-to-prison pipeline if we do not recognize that it is a race problem. So I think in some ways it's been disappointing and heartbreaking. And in other ways, I have had discussions with Dr. Maddox and Dr. Mbenga, and those have been hopeful, and Dr. Bullock, and those have been more hopeful. But I do want to say, even in the hopefulness, I have found a degree of despair and recognizing that this is a huge problem, that you can still be a great school in a great district, but have systemic racism running rampant.
We're talking about ways to address the school-to-prison pipeline today on The State of Things. Fatima Saleh is a reverend pastoral consultant in the Triangle area and author of a Facebook post on ISS that went viral and prompted this conversation. Laverne Maddox-Perry is Senior Executive Director of Student Support Services for the Durham Public Schools. Laverne, talk about that. You mentioned it, too, that these are sometimes difficult conversations
yes.
to have. And you just heard Fatima say there are schools and administrators that just don't want to acknowledge it. How much progress are we making in school district and building by building in getting administrators to acknowledge that race is an issue here?
So it is a cultural shift. And for those of us who are trying to lead this work, there are a couple of things you do. We always ask the question, what do you change first? Do you wait to change someone's mindset, or do you change behavior? And what we're doing is a little bit of both. And we are trying to be very strategic in saying, here are the expectations. The expectations are that every student that walks through our doors is going to feel respected, is going to be valued, and our goal is to have them pursue whatever post-secondary dreams they have. And that's why we exist as an organization. And you have to believe that, and we're going to give you the tools, the learning, and the support you need to make that happen while always helping our parents feel that their kids are in the most supportive, safest place they can be to continue their education.
But what happens? I mean, you know, if a student comes with a bevy of personal problems and behaves badly, you talk about whether you address the behavior first or the attitude, they break the rule. They're thrown out of school. That's it. And we can understand. So if there's an administrator that doesn't quite understand that race is a problem, what do you do?
We have to work with, you know, we have to assess what is the block. Let's say, for instance, mm-hmm. there is an administrator who does not yet hasn't gotten to that, mm-hmm. That insight yet. It is our jobs as leaders to get them to that insight. And as educators, one thing that is hard to argue with is facts. And so we look for research-based and evidence-based ways to get leaders to understand that we're in this business to get results for families and for kids. And we can tell you up front, this is the best way to get results for families and kids. And so it's hard for anyone to argue with that. And we have a very detailed strategic plan that outlines guiding principles of not just our school board, but our superintendent. And as a district, we are going to live up to that.
Laverne Maddox-Perry is Senior Executive Director of Student Support Services at Durham Public Schools. Thank you so much for being on our
Thank
program.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Reverend Fatima Saleh is a pastoral consultant at the Triangle, wrote a post on Facebook about her experience shadowing her son at in-school suspension at the Durham School of the Arts. Fatima, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to hear more about racial equity report cards from the Southern Coalition for Social Justice and hear how restorative justice can transform lives and schools. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. In North Carolina public schools, black students are more than four times more likely than white students to receive a short-term suspension. And that is just one of the racial discrepancies outlined in the Southern Coalition for Social Justice's new racial equity report card. Today, we're talking with experts about the racial divide in discipline in North Carolina schools and creative ways to tackle the problem. Peggy Nicholson is the director of the Youth Justice Project with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, and she joins me now. Peggy, welcome.
Thank you.
Talk about this. This is the third year your organization has put out this report. Tell us what you found this year and how it compares with the previous two.
Yeah, so we put out these reports because we think it's so important that every school district not just look at their overall suspension rates or overall academic achievement, but really break that information out by race, because you do see huge disproportionate outcomes where students of color are not getting the same academic opportunities and they're being punished more harshly in schools in almost every district and across North Carolina. So this is the third year that we've done it, and I wish I could say that the numbers have changed significantly. But the numbers and the disproportionality has really stayed consistent throughout those 3 years.
Tell us what you found this year.
Yeah, so in North Carolina, white students in elementary and middle school are twice as likely to be considered college and career ready than their black peers. Black students are, as you said, over four times more likely to get a short-term suspension, more likely to be referred to juvenile court from school. That, to us, is a civil rights issue because it impacts their access to education. And until we figure out what is stemming this inequity and address it, it's going to continue to be a civil rights issue.
What about if students of color are just breaking the rules more often? Is that not a possibility?
Research has pretty definitively shown that black students are not less academically capable. They are not acting up more seriously or more often. This is not about the deficits of individual students. This is about institutional policies and practices that have disadvantaged students of color.
Talk about those policies. How does that work?
Well, I mean, one, the approach we have to discipline really illustrates this. You know, if you look at nationwide where the highest rates of suspensions are, they're often in states that also have the highest populations of black students. So suspension is kind of a continuation of this, you know, use of harsh punishment to control certain populations. And so when you approach discipline in that punitive way, you're going to see these negative outcomes borne by the populations like students of color who have been most marginalized.
And you can see, I mean, if you have a policy where if you're in school suspension to begin with, and then you fall asleep and mm-hmm. you've got two more days, now you're really on a path, aren't you?
Right.
And it doesn't take much once you get put in that system to then be a recidivist and to feel not part of the larger group.
Just one suspension increases your chances of dropping out and being involved in the court system.
And the correlation between dropping out and the court system is also pretty close to that.
Very tightly.
You actually worked with legal aid before this position with the Youth Justice Project and have your own reflections on how students are criminalized in our system.
Yeah, so I represented hundreds of students across the state, and I saw students as young as 8 years old refer to juvenile court I had one student who was 8, and we can actually refer students as young as 6 in juvenile court in North Carolina, but this 8-year-old was a student with a disability who, in a moment of anger and frustration, shook his pencil at the teacher, and he was sent to juvenile court for communicating threats. And, of course, the juvenile court judge dismissed that case, but not after the student had to miss school, his parents had to take off work to go to those hearings. And this is a student who did have a disability that was undiagnosed and not being provided any services for that disability, which should be the first response of the school rather than involving law enforcement.
So there's a need for an overhaul and some close examination building by building. Until then, restorative justice is one of the ways in which, even if we're being disproportionately sent into these situations, talk about restorative justice and whether or not it has any promise in this situation.
I think restorative justice being implemented with true fidelity is a little bit new, and it does require some time before we know fully what the research says. The preliminary results are very positive. Some recent studies have come out that are really comprehensive studies looking at the use of restorative justice in one study in Pittsburgh in elementary school. And not only did it significantly drive down suspensions, it also addressed that racial disproportionality, which is we see a lot of programs that can reduce suspensions, but that disproportionality still exists. This actually had the effect of doing both of those things.
Well, restorative justice programs are changing the way teachers and school administrators handle tough cases, and the idea is to find creative ways of mediating conflicts. Ultimately, the programs are about cutting off the school-to-prison pipeline and making sure students can actually complete their education. John Powell has been working in restorative justice for more than a decade. He directs the Restorative Justice Clinic at Campbell University. His program has implemented big changes in schools all over North Carolina, with a special focus on Wake County, where I think John has been working the longest. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
Describe this program. How does it work in schools, or how can they work? I think there are multiple ways, right?
Multiple ways. We use two major restorative practices. One is a direct intervention when kids have either already gotten in a physical altercation or there's a serious verbal altercation that we know is headed that way. We've created relationships with 39 schools in the Wake County system, and that's a significant increase. We started with two back in 2009 when the law school moved to Raleigh. We get referrals from these schools. We schedule time for a couple of my clinical students and myself, or a full-time assistant that works in the program, to go to the school where the children are. The process is to meet with them individually to begin with, first of all, for them to understand who we are and what this program is going to look like for them. Give them an opportunity to talk to us about what happened in the physical altercation or the verbal altercation. Lead them in a discussion about how has this affected you and others, because we're trying to understand what the harm of this has been, because the crux of restorative justice is try to understand harm and repair harm. And then the last step, once we've identified a harm, is to talk to them about how they might be able to work together with their disputant to address that harm and make things as right as possible.
You talked about referrals. When do schools come to you? Why does a school decide that they're going to try restorative justice? Because it's not a mandate, right?
It's not a mandate. Restorative practices always need to be seen as an invitation. And kids are not mandated to come, just because they're referred. We've been around long enough now, and the popularity of the program has grown enough that we get inquiries now. There was a day when I was beating on people's doors saying, please listen to me about this. But those days are gone. We get a lot of phone calls and inquiries about this. We actually do a monthly orientation for up to 20 Wake County employees at a time who come into the law school, and we do a two-hour restorative practices orientation. That usually leads to a meeting with leadership in their school. That usually leads to a memorandum of understanding where we create a relationship where we can start providing the direct services. And we also do a lot of training in schools around the other predominant restorative practice, which is the circle process.
Well, talk more about that, because it sounds to me like there might be some skepticism around this whole process. Some kid gets to say, I'm sorry, talk to everybody involved, and is off the hook without really paying for what he did.
If that's the way it was, I'd be skeptical too. But I have had people that have said to me, it's a lot harder to sit across the table from the person that I've offended against than it would be just to take the punishment that somebody has to give me. And in my mind, the results are much, much better when you can sit with a person that you've been in conflict with and you can get to know them on a human level and make a human connection and begin to create the empathy that was lacking before when the offense happened. And once you can do that, results can be very positive. And so that is what we're doing when we're sitting with students and trying to lead them through this process. Because ultimately, in the facilitated dialogue or the mediation process, as long as they are willing and as long as we think it can be done in a safe and productive way, which is almost every time, we do bring them together for a face-to-face meeting where they can go through the things that I just talked about.
What kind of results have you seen on a building basis? Do you get called in just for a particular event, or does this become the way the school handles discipline?
This is, for the schools that we have relationship with, this is becoming one of the ways that they are handling discipline. But these schools are very interested in reducing suspension, and they are aware of the disproportionality of minority contact with suspensions and arrests in the past and those kinds of zero tolerance kinds of policies. So they are going to restorative practices that are becoming the way that they do business in the schools. That does not mean that every school that we have a relationship with has stopped suspending students. They still suspend students from time to time. But one example of how they are moving toward this is instead of a five-day suspension, they'll talk to a kid about a three-day suspension and coming back and doing a restorative practice. Or they may say, we have an alternative learning center and we would like to put you there. We don't want to send you home. We would like to put you there until the mediators can get out here. So they may be in an alternative learning center for a couple of days with instructors in the room until we can get out and mediate the conflict.
So what kind of results are you seeing?
We're seeing really phenomenal results from the schools that we are working with. And I'll just give you an example. One of the most active schools that we have is Knightdale High School. And they regularly send us reports about reoffense rates and those kinds of things. And we started with them about 4 years ago. And so they started with the levels of assaultive behavior, incidents of physical assault, before they were doing restorative practices and incidents of that now. They have dramatically come down. Now, they had a blip last year, and I think a lot of people had a blip last year. But even when they had the spike, the kids that were going through the restorative practices almost never reoffended against each other, almost never had another dispute with another child. And it really, when you look at the numbers, it is almost, from a guy that comes from my background as a criminal defense attorney, it almost seems like it's too good to be true. Mm. But it is true, and those numbers are consistent across the board with the schools that we work with.
How do you think it addresses, or does it address, the disproportionate number of students of color who are sent in the first place?
Well, one thing that I think Peggy's work will show and the numbers show is that schools, Wake County schools, have made improvements in suspension rates. Suspension rates are coming down. The next frontier is going to be attacking the disproportionate minority in the suspensions that they are using. So we've seen improvement in suspension rates. We've seen some improvement in disproportionate minority contact, but not the kind of improvement that we need to see. The other piece of this that we use so much is the circle process, and I think that has a lot of potential to help with that, because the circle process predominantly is used in the beginning to get to know each other at deeper levels.
And describe the process.
The process is where we can bring a larger number of people together, for example, in a classroom setting. We use an object called a talking piece. We have prompts that we give them, so there's a circle keeper that comes in with prompts. The keeper will give the class a prompt and then pass the talking piece to the person on either side of them. That person then has an invitation to answer the prompt and then pass it to the person beside them. So it proceeds in an orderly fashion around the circle, comes back to the keeper, and then the keeper can give another prompt. What we encourage schools to do initially is to not try to address conflict in circles, but try to strengthen community by building relationship. Another important aspect of this is it's not just for the kids. What staff members realize when we come in and do our initial whole staff trainings, they almost invariably say, we need to do this as a staff. So it can be a very healthy thing for staff. It can be a very healthy thing for children. And it does need to be taken as a long-term approach. This is not something you can be trained to do in 2 hours. We give an initial two-hour training. We go back in and give a whole staff training. We go back in for people that this resonates with and put them in a two-day training, and then we have the ability to go in and begin to coach them through so that they can do this with fidelity.
We're talking about restorative justice, the way it can be used in schools to bring down suspension rates and perhaps address the disparity that we see in discipline programs across the state. And we're talking about that today on The State of Things. Talking to John Powell, an attorney and the director of the Restorative Justice Clinic at Campbell University. And Peggy Nicholson is the Youth Justice Project Director at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. Peggy, talk about we talked about recidivism. Those rates go down. In fact, often students who've been in these restorative practice processes don't repeat. What do you see in other schools, or do you have data on recidivism, kids who are suspended once, and how many times after that they may be suspended or disciplined?
Right. There's been lots of research done on kind of the harmful individual impacts of suspension, that kids who are suspended are more likely to be suspended again, end up in the court system, as we talked about. And even more importantly, there's been a lot of research showing that high rates of suspension in a school don't improve that school's overall climate. A lot of people say, well, we have to suspend these kids for the benefit of the other kids who are here to learn. Well, we've seen through the research that suspension actually doesn't achieve that goal. Something like restorative justice that still prioritizes accountability, but also in prioritizes student learning, are things that are going to more likely achieve both kind of good individual outcomes and improving the overall school climate.
Well, often when suspension rates, where we see suspension rates go down, we also see academic performance in that building go up. Those are very closely correlated.
Absolutely. And overall school climate, a positive school climate, is very closely tied to overall academic achievement. And so things that are going to promote a good school climate, like having strong relationships with other students and teachers, are the an early intervention, so we don't even get to that point of conflict, are the things that are going to really boost academic achievement.
You talked about building empathy, John, and the way this works. This larger circle, talk about the theory of that, because there really the student, perhaps the offender, is forced to see the ripple effect, not just perhaps the teacher or the individual they got in the beef with. There are larger consequences that may never occur to anybody. And is that who's involved in the circle? Is that the idea?
I think so. And one way that we know that we are being successful is when children have conflict and they go to an administrator and say, we need to circle up. That says an awful lot about the value that they get from this. One reason we do circle is so that it improves our ability to enrich our lives outside of circle. And so certainly we're wanting kids to be in circle in school, where we have them for so many hours of the day, so that their lives in school and outside of school can be better. Another ripple effect, Frank, is that they go home and talk about this with their parents. And so one thing that's happening in some of our elementary schools that we happen to have a pilot program through the Kellogg Foundation with is that parents are being invited to come into the school and do circles with their children and with their teachers and with their administrators, and they're being kept by an experienced circle keeper. So that has been a lot of fun to watch.
That's another hour of eye contact and not phone contact. Right. In addition, if that's all you did, John.
Right.
I'm sure some people would consider it a win. John Powell is an attorney and the director of the Restorative Justice Clinic at Campbell University. Thank you, John. Always good to see you.
Thank you, Frank.
And Peggy Nicholson is director of the Youth Justice Project at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. Peggy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can find links to their work at our website, stateofthings.org. And the State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.